PDM.
I am. Thank you. So actually, what I hope to tell you about is not so much the search for the electron EDM as the search for better ways of making cold molecules so that we can improve the search for the EDM in the hope that we may eventually, before too long, find it. So here's a couple of introductory slides. The idea of measuring the electric dipole moment of the electron is actually the idea of searching for new elementary particle physics. And you should think that the electron is really just a little antenna listening to the vacuum fluctuations of all the particles and fields that are out there, including the ones that we don't know about. And that coupling determines how big the dipole moment is. And what this is showing you is that if the only stuff out there is the stuff we know about, then the dipole moment of the electron is extremely small. That's why it's at the bottom of this graph, 10 to the minus 38 e centimeters or thereabouts. On the other hand, if there's new physics at about the energy scale that is currently of interest for the LHC, that is to say round about 1 tera electron volt, 1 TeV, then most theories, of which I list one or two here, predict something in this broad band of energy, in this broad band of dipole moment, which is related to the energy where the new physics is. If the energy where the new physics is were higher, then the dipole moment would typically, generically, be smaller. But then also, elementary particle physicists would be out of a job, so many of them still like to think that there's something around about 1 TeV. To explain just very briefly how it is that this size comes about, let me just make a diagram, lowest order kind of diagram. So this is exactly the same diagram you get in quantum electrodynamics when you try to calculate the correction to the magnetic moment. Instead of the g factor of the electron being 2, it's a little bit different, and that difference is called g minus 2. And you get it by imagining that an electron emits and then reabsorbs a virtual photon. And the difference here is that the particle being emitted and absorbed is one of these supersymmetric particles. But basically, it's exactly the same sort of idea, and it happens at the lowest one-loop level, as well as all the other levels. And there's a famous alpha over pi, which comes into the g minus 2 calculation. But here also the mass of the particles, of the new particle, comes in. So you can see if the new particle is heavier, then this denominator gets to be bigger, and the dipole gets to be smaller. But this is somehow a plausible range if you think there's new physics at about this energy scale. And the phi is important. The phi is a phase whose value nobody knows, and it relates to the violation of CP symmetry. And I mention it because it's known that the standard model, it's believed that the standard model is not able to explain the amount of the excess of matter over antimatter that we see when astronomers look out into the universe, and that's thought to be produced by CP violation in the early universe. It's a famous paper by Sakharov in the 1960s, I think. 60s? So, standard model has not enough CP violation as far as we know. We think it's required to explain how we come to be here. So some more CP violation must happen. It should happen if there's new physics here. So the electron EDM is a way of looking for that. This is sensitivity here. It's about 10 to the minus 25 to 10 to the minus 30 in these units. Now that's actually very small, and if you start thinking about how you could measure that with a bare electron, it's pretty depressing. But in the 1960s, 1964, I think, Sanders pointed out that if the electron that you want to study is actually just an unpaired electron in an atom or molecule, it's possible then for the system to have an amplified dipole moment. So the dipole moment of the electron is polarizing the molecule or atom and giving it a bigger dipole moment, by this factor eta. And when that interacts with the electric field, you have an interaction energy here, which includes these two terms, the enhancement factor, eta, and the electric field, E. So I could think about this as an amplified field rather than an amplified dipole moment. And I could call this thing here the effective field, the field with which the dipole moment interacts. And if you study how big that effective field is, it's got two bits basically. One of them has to do with the details of the structure, and it requires this thing to be relativistic, so there's something like a factor of z cubed coming into the size of the effect, and the form, basic form for this, for the size of this was worked out by Flambaum, I think, in 1974. And then it depends on the polarization of the system. So we like the ytterbium fluoride molecule because it has two key features. It's got a heavy nucleus in it, so there's a place in this molecule where the electron is traveling at relativistic speeds, and we get this z cubed enhancement. And also it's highly polarizable. I'm really talking here about the polarization that comes with a diatomic polar molecule of just lining up with the electric field. So to polarize this molecule, I need no perturbation of the electronic states. All I need to do is mix rotational states. And that's why it's polarizable, because the rotational states are close together. So the energy denominator for when you work out the polarization is a small energy denominator, and that gives you a big polarization. And in a lab field, you can pretty much saturate the polarization of this molecule. And what I'm showing you here is that effective electric field in gigavolts per centimeter plotted against the applied electric field in kilovolts per centimeter. In fact, we use 10 kilovolts per centimeter in our lab, and it gives us about 15 gigavolts per centimeter. So this enhancement factor of a million is tremendously helpful in trying to measure the EDM. A million times bigger than you would get if you just thought about a single bare electron coupling to a field. And that's important, very important as a practical matter, because now you only need to control the magnetic fields at the nanogauss level. And while that's challenging, it's perfectly doable, whereas the femtogauss level is pushing your luck. So how we do it, we have a molecular beam here. This is just a standard pulse supersonic beam. Pulses of molecules come down the beam line. They fluoresce when they pass through this probe laser. And here's a signal in the PMT, which tells us a pulse of molecules has gone by. Here we have a pump laser, which helps us to prepare the state of the molecule by some optical pumping. And then we have an RF pulse. And I don't want to go into the, have no time to go into the details of this, but let me just say the combination of the pump laser and the RF pulse spin polarizes the molecule perpendicular to this electric field. So I have an electric field up and down, and I have an electron spin pointing towards you. And if there's a dipole moment, of course the spin will precess because there's a torque, D cross E. So as the molecule flies along the machine, you'll see the spin direction rotate through an angle which is proportional to the dipole moment of the electron. And it's proportional to the enhancement factor. So now all I need to do is read out the rotation angle of the spin, and that can be done with another RF pulse and then this laser detection. And what happens is as the rotation precession angle changes, so the height of this pulse goes up and down. In fact, I can plot how that works by putting on a magnetic field which purposely winds the spin around. And I see the height of my signal going up and down like this. It's just a kind of spin polarimeter, or we like to think of it as an interferometer, to measure the spin rotation angle phi. So doing that, using that, we're able to measure the electric dipole moment of the electron. We reverse the electric fields, we switch the magnetic fields, we do a lot of other stuff. But in the end, we're just measuring this precession angle that comes from the D cross E torque. And we've done a lot of measurements in 2011. We did 6,194 measurements, 6 minutes each, at 10 kilovolts per centimeter. And these were some of the results, and the rest of them are coming. So this is all the results from this data set. And in the end, this particular data set had something like 25 million beam shots. And so each one of these 6,000-something measurements is a value and an error bar. And it's interesting to think that if they had all come from a single parent distribution and we just plot their number divided by its error bar, you might expect a Gaussian distribution of width 1. And when we did that, because we've got so many measurements, you get lots of good numbers for making a histogram, we could see that it really wasn't true. So what happens is sometimes the machine is noisier, sometimes the noise is not random. Actually, all experimenters know that not just sometimes, always your noise is not random if you look in the low frequency part of the spectrum. And because people are concerned about the result, we wanted to make sure that we knew what the confidence level of the measurement was. About a method that statisticians have called the bootstrap method. This is a way of getting the best estimate that you can of the parent distribution of a noisy signal based on the data set itself. So we use the data set itself to tell us what the distribution is. It's not very different from Gaussian, but it's not exactly Gaussian. And that allowed us to know what the probability distribution was. So before I show you the result, let me just tell you about the previous result, which came from thallium atoms from Gene Cummins' group in Berkeley. This is Regan et al., involving Dave DeMille. And they published the result that there was an upper limit of 1.6 times 10 to the minus 27 with 90% confidence. And an important part of that conversion from experimental result into EDM is the theory. So the theory is telling you what the enhancement factor is. And so they used the existing theory of the day, which was by Liu and Kelly from 92, and they had 90% confidence in this level. Now the theory has shifted a little bit, a very little bit. In 2009, a new calculation by Zuber and Flambaum gave almost exactly the same result, very, very slightly less sensitive, and therefore the confidence level just very, very slightly smaller. And then more recently still, there's been a publication by an Indian group using a somewhat different method, and for the moment they have a different sensitivity factor again. But in any case, while the theorists work out what's going on here, you can comfortably say that the upper limit from thallium is something like 1.6 times 10 to the minus 27 with some reasonably high confidence. So our result is this. We have a central value of minus 2.4 times 10 to the minus 28. This is our statistical error, and this is our systematic error. And I want to make the point, it's an important point, that our systematic error, I haven't explained to you how we got it, that's a whole hour-long talk, but our systematic error is really based entirely on measurements. That's how we figure out what the systematic uncertainty is. If we can measure stuff more accurately, then our systematic error would be smaller. So by improving the statistical noise, we will improve both the systematic error and the statistical error. When we combine these things together, we get an upper limit with 90% confidence of this, of 1 times 10 to the minus 27. So one would say that's quite a modest improvement over what was done before with the thallium atoms. But here's what's exciting. The thallium atoms was a real tour de force. It was the last gasp of an old method struggling mightily against some systematic errors that are really difficult to control, with an enhancement factor that doesn't benefit from the huge polarizability of molecules. So this one, on the other hand, is the first breath of something new, which has got a long way to go. And what's good about it? It's got the higher polarizability, it's got a bigger enhancement factor, and also, though I didn't discuss it, it has a much better immunity to systematic errors, and that makes the experiment much easier to do. So even though we have very few YBF molecules in this experiment, compared with the huge number of thallium atoms in this experiment, even so, we're able to achieve a result which is of the same sort of size or even slightly better. So what I want to spend the rest of my time on is telling you about prospects for the future and why this is an exciting direction. So how are we improving this? There are three phases. Phase one is going on now, small upgrades. It's producing about a factor of three improvement. Phase two involves a new kind of source which is almost ready, and I'll tell you a bit about that. And then phase three involves laser cooling the molecules to make a molecular fountain, and that's just starting. So phase one, we've slightly lengthened the interferometer. If you just have a longer time for the spin to process, then the same EDM will give you a bigger angle. And obviously, if you get a bigger angle, you have more sensitivity, so you can detect a smaller EDM. We've also got rid of some background, and all of this gives us about 2.5 times better sensitivity. We've already, over the last year, explored and understood everything about the systematics in this setup, and we have a total systematic error that's below 10 to the minus 28 from all our preliminary measurements, and we will get additional information on that as we take EDM data, which we're doing now. So we hope by late this year to be at the level of 2 × 10⁻²⁸, 1 sigma, which means probably 4 × 10⁻²⁴ or 5 × 10⁻²⁸ at the 90% confidence level. So a factor of 2 improvement or possibly more over where we are now. Phase 2 is this new buffer gas source. So it's a cryogenic source. We have a helium cell here, which is at 3 Kelvin. Inside it is helium. That's the little blue dots. And then we have a target, which contains a terbium metal and also fluorine atoms. And we can whack that with a laser. And so a plume of stuff comes out. It's about 20,000 degrees, so it's the same as the sun. And then very hot, complicated chemistry happens, and it all collides with the helium, and miraculously, some YBF gets made, and it comes out the hole here and makes a YBF beam. So we've looked a little bit inside the cell. We see these pictures here. These are pictures showing you the absorption of light by the YBF molecules as they form and move around inside the cell as a function of time. So the helium is coming in at the bottom, the cell is here, the target is over to the side here, and the exit hole is here. The beam is supposed to come out here. And what you see as time develops is quite interesting. These pale yellow stripes, that's what the YBF is doing. But let's zero in on one of them. It looks like this. There are vortices here. What you can see here is that the YBF is swirling around here and here. Sometimes you can't see it on the projector, so I've just done this to make sure you see what I'm talking about. These are vortices. There's also a beam coming out here, but what we'll see is over a period of time, you can already see it here, the straight out beam is kind of disappearing, but the YBF stuck in the vortices is still there. So we bought a program which is designed for fluid dynamics, and we love the name because we work in the Center for Cold Matter, which is CCM, and the name of this program is STAR-CCM+. It allows us to model our cell. Our cell has the most bizarre geometry, which comes about for no good reason but just the accident of history. That's what it looks like, and you can already see when we look at the flow velocity of the helium, there's a vortex here and a vortex here. It's just what we saw in the lab. So if we ask this program to tell us the density of YBF at various times, you can see now initially there's some YBF here being pushed up. Initially we just put a stripe of YBF across the bottom of the simulation. So there was a red stripe across here, that's the YBF. The helium pushes it up. But pretty soon you see there's not much left in the middle. It's been pushed out by the helium and we've formed these vortices on each side. And the YBF is just sitting there gradually diffusing to the walls instead of coming out the hole where we would like it to be. So clearly we need to improve our cell design, and in fact we've now built a new cell and we're just starting to test it. And if we were to believe STAR-CCM, it would give us 100 times more molecules coming out the hole. But I don't believe STAR-CCM. We have to do the experiment and see. So that's what we have. It gives us a beam with a velocity that we can tune between 50 and 200 meters per second. The intensity in a single hyperfine ground state sublevel is here, 1 or 2 × 10⁻¹⁰ per steradian per pulse. And here's the time profile. So it's about a 10 millisecond pulse, but it has this interminable tail. And most of the molecules are actually in this tail. And that's the stuff that was trapped in vortices, and some of it makes its way out late. And here's the simulation. So apart from a slight difference in the start time, the simulation tells us exactly what we see. And I think the difference in start time is just to do with the fact that we, in our simulation, we put this strip of molecules in a particular place, which is probably not where they start. So that's the story on inside the cell. This is looking at a rotational spectrum of molecules outside the cell. So lots of rotational lines, they help us to know that the rotational temperature is 4 Kelvin, so the beam is cold, it's more or less in equilibrium with the helium. And we can also measure the translational temperature, and that's 5 Kelvin. So here's the story. We have 10 times more molecules per pulse with this source than we do with our standard supersonic jet beam. I call it standard, but it's actually it's the result of many years, 15 years of gradual improvement and development. So it's as good as it's going to get. This is a real jump forward. And also, it's going slower. It's four times slower, so we get four times longer interaction time. And so now you can work out, what does that do for the signal to noise? The signal is four times bigger. That's to say, the precession angle of the spin is four times bigger, and the statistical noise is better by root 10. So that's an order of magnitude or more improvement, and so it should give us access to the mid 10 to the minus 29 range. So that's phase two. And now I want to talk a little bit about phase three. How long have I got now? How many?
10,
perfect. So phase three is the laser-cooled YBF fountain, and this requires a little bit of discussion. Let me first of all tell you about the cooling scheme. This idea was first written down by DeRosa a number of years ago now, and was also demonstrated in Dave DeMille's lab. This molecule, YBF, is one of a class of molecules where the problem of vibrational changing, spontaneous emission that changes the vibrational state is not such a big problem. So these are molecules where the optically active electron is not involved in the binding of the molecule. So even when you excite the electron, you don't really change the internuclear potential. So that means that the harmonic oscillator bit of the potential is the same, whether you're in the ground state or the excited state. And then when the decay happens, there's a selection rule of delta V equals zero. So that's the idea. So we excite from V equals zero up to V equals zero at 552 nanometers, which is the resonance line of YBF molecule. This is the X state. This is the A state. And here, there's a mistake. So here we have n equals 1, rotational state n equals 1, and this is rotational state n equals 0. I was writing this about 10 minutes ago, so forgive me. Sorry, it's not right. That's a 0. So the rotational state 0 has nowhere to go and conserve the electric dipole selection rules except back to here. So that's the cooling transition for Doppler cooling. But 6% of the time, it goes off this way. So it's not as good as DeMille's strontium fluoride, but it's not too bad. And we have to collect these molecules and put them back where they should be. So there's a repump laser here, which brings them back to here, and then they can be back in the cooling cycle. Now, for these types of molecules, a rough rule of thumb would be that the next bad decay from here out to vehicles 2 would be just 6% of 6%. And that's how it turns out. So that's the branching ratio down to here, and we have to pop that back as well. And now you see we can get quite a lot of scattering events and still keep the molecules within the cooling cycle. So that's the plan. And just one more technical point, that actually this molecule has hyperfine structure. So we use an isotope of ytterbium that has no spin, but fluorine nucleus has a spin. So there's four hyperfine lines. Each one of these lines is really four lines. So we have to modulate the laser beams. Each beam has to produce four frequencies. So there are 12 frequencies in total here. But it's all doable, and we're doing it. However, we're starting out by a simpler system, learning. We've been learning with a simpler system over the last couple of years, which is calcium fluoride. And this is just some data showing how we slow a calcium fluoride beam. It's a 600 meter per second supersonic jet beam of calcium fluoride. And this is data on the left. So we shine a cooling laser, just head on into the beam to try and slow it down. And if you just pulse on the cooling laser for 200 microseconds, what you see is the red curve is with no cooling laser. And the blue curve is what you get with this 200 microseconds of cooling. And you see that some molecules have been transferred from over here, arriving early, to over here, arriving late. So that's the slowing down of the molecules. And according to some simulation that we do, it should look like this. And it looks a little bit like this, though the resolution is not as good as it is here. If we shine the laser on for longer, the cooling works better. So now it's quite clear that we're transferring molecules from this region to this region here. and it's very similar to what we get with the simulation. And if we shine the light for longer still, now we're up to 1 millisecond, we can even begin to see a second dip, a second peak here. And that's just the notch in the velocity distribution. The laser has notched out these guys and moved them up to here, but it can't attack the other ones because they're not close enough. The Doppler shift has them out of resonance. So molecules that are close enough to be able to interact with the laser get transferred over to here, and it's clearer there, but it's the same story. So we think we understand what we're doing, and we think it's working. And the same simulation that tells us what this distribution of arrival times should look like also tells us what the velocity distribution is. We don't measure the velocity distribution, we measure the arrival time. But since we like the look of our simulations, we think we can ask them what the velocity distribution is. And it looks much nicer in velocity space. So you see, for 0.5 millisecond, you've taken these guys and slowed them down. And for 1 millisecond, it's here. And for 1.3, it's here. Now, what you'll find is it doesn't matter how long you wait now, a group of molecules has been taken and moved to a slower velocity, and that's it. And you can wait forever, you won't get any slower molecules because of the Doppler shift. There's just a limit to how much you can change the velocity. So obviously the next thing, this corresponds to a width of about 30 millikelvins. The next thing is to chirp the lasers so that we can really start to move that velocity group down to much lower velocities. And we've done some chirping in our lab, and we see the peak move. But the data right now is still pretty ropey, so I'm not going to show them, except just to say it's clearly going to work. So what we really want to do is to make some optical molasses of ytterbium fluoride. And a key starting point is to load that molasses from a thermal beam. And as luck would have it, a design has already been published by John Doyle's group of a thermal beam. Here's the velocity distribution of molecules coming out of such a source. And the important point here is that these guys are slow enough to be captured in optical molasses. So 3D optical molasses can capture the slow molecules coming out of a thermal source. And here's a simulation showing you in one dimension. This is the phase space diagram. So that's the speed and that's the position. And the main point is to see that the distribution of speeds is squashed down by this molasses, so that here we have a cold cloud of molecules. And if we ask the simulation what the temperature does, well, it cools down, of course, to the Doppler temperature because it's a Doppler cooling simulation. The important piece of information that we needed, and the reason we did this, was to find out how quickly does it cool. The answer is it cools in a few milliseconds. By the time you get to 6 or 7 milliseconds, it's cooled down to the Doppler temperature. But at 2 milliseconds, it's still up here at some tens of milli K, which is why the temperature of our calcium fluoride beam that I showed you here, why this is at 30 milli K. We just haven't been able to cool it for long enough. So here's the idea. Molecules come out of such a source. We push them off to the side to get them out of the wind of the helium. Then we laser cool them. And once they get to the Doppler temperature, we hope they'll cool lower than the Doppler. They should be subject to Sisyphus cooling, so they should get colder. But even if they just get to the Doppler temperature, this will work. And then the idea is to push them up, EDM experiment with the electric field and the RF pulses and so forth. And the benefit is, obviously, you get a 0.5 second flight time instead of 0.5 millisecond flight time. So that's the gain is about 1,000 in the rotation angle. And the loss is that you have fewer molecules, but not so many fewer. It's remarkably good. And we calculate in this paper here that the statistical sensitivity in 8 hours should be something like 6 × 10⁻³¹. So that's exciting. How's my time doing? It's basically zero, right? OK. I was going to just comment that there are other experiments you know about. I think the thorium oxide in the ACME collaboration. There's the tungsten carbide in Michigan. Unfortunate name, but there you go. And hafnium fluoride iron, trapped iron in Geelong. And some people are working with optical lattices in the hope that they could do experiments on trapped cesium atoms. There's also an experiment on francium atoms in Japan. So here's the status. Over the years, the upper limit on the electron EDM has come down. These two points here are what we get from YBF. This was an initial proof of principle, and this was a result that I just told you about. So we're experimentalists, many of us. You know what to do. That's the answer. I've also told you that we'll get down to the sort of 10 to the minus 30 level by this laser cooling. And so that's where we are. I think we can hope by 2020, or maybe a little sooner is my hope, that's even achievable. The neutron sits a bit higher, about a factor of 30 times higher. Theory typically says the neutron is higher as well. These are some other particles. And stop talking, no time left. Summary. Okay, it's a good thing to measure the EDM. You learn something fundamental. We think we can get to 10 to the minus 30. Right now, some people are surprised that the electron doesn't have a dipole moment. And I want to acknowledge an important contribution of these three colleagues, Johnny Hudson, Mike Tarbert, and Ben Sauer, and various postdocs and students who've worked on this complicated project. That's it.
Okay, so it's time for questions, yeah?
What about something like ytterbium iodide? You said you wanted a small rotational constant.
I think we're okay with the rotational constant we have. I haven't looked at it. I think iodine has a higher nuclear spin, does it not?
That may be, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a big one. Certainly one issue for us, high degeneracy means you don't get so many in the state you want. And also it means it's more difficult to have complete control. I mean, the fully quantum, this is a 1.5 qubit quantum computer that we have here. We absolutely have to be fully in control of all the qubit rotations. So simplicity is good. And I think that's maybe an issue with the iodides, but it may be a fine case, I don't know.
Ed, I noticed in the rotational spectrum you had all the isotopes present.
Yeah.
Since there's six different similar abundance isotopes, is there any possibility of using isotopically pure samples, or is that possible?
At the moment, I think we're making headway without doing that, but if I knew how to get isotopically, I mean, it is the most abundant isotope that we work with. So, but yeah, we could get, if we had isotopically enriched YB samples, then we could get a free factor of three or so. So, yeah, it's probably a question of money, Paul, but I don't know for sure how much. I think it's a lot. I mean, we're talking about something the size of a penny or a dime or something like that.
It's beautiful stuff, and I love the attention to the details that you give us. You know, just when you showed the 6,000 measurements, dancing bias, and I mean, you quite visually, you would see sort of these episodes,
yeah,
where the noise is larger,
yeah.
Which is something that, you know, one recognizes from every experiment that I think I've ever done. Is it fair to say that the broadening that you were seeing in your that made it super Gaussian were basically those episodes that we would be able to immediately see in the data, or is it really more insidiously interspersed throughout all the measurements that you're taking?
It's more insidious. And I think I know why. It's because we've spent a great deal of effort and thought in designing our switching waveforms, of which there are many, to not be fooled, to not be sensitive to the correlated noise. I mean, the obvious thing you do with a lock-in detection is modulate fast to get out of the 1 over F noise. So I think it's deeper than that. I think, I mean, we certainly don't see any clear correlation. If we saw a clear correlation between, you know, the noise tails and those events, we would probably just cut those events out because they're easy to identify. But we don't. So I think it's more subtle stuff.
You had a bit sketchy way of the guide. Can you tell me what the guide actually is? And I was wondering, in your fountain experiment, would it actually help to have the guide really sticking into the helium chamber so you could have some increase there?
Yeah. So we have thought a little about a magnetic guide. So in our paper and our planning and thinking about this experiment, it's a magnetic guide. The guide is not built. I'm well aware that there's a real practical issue about bringing a magnetic guide close to this region where we want to do the laser cooling and the EDM experiment, and how to get all the vacuum stuff sorted out and the high field and the low field sorted out. It's not really sorted out. But I think a magnetic guide can work, and we're imagining that it will be done with permanent magnets, and that we'll have a mirror on the end to allow the flux return donut on the end to get a quick drop in magnetic field to a low value in the place where the mott is, where the molasses is.
Yeah, I actually meant the reverse. What happens if you have the guide really into the buffer cell, into the helium buffer cell? Would you have a buildup of YBF on the axis because of the trapping fields?
You might. That might be something that we could do. I mean, there's an issue about the slow molecules coming out of the source. They love to get boosted as they come out, and we rely on the slow molecules. So it might even be better for us to have the guide go inside the cell, so that we don't get or we have less boosting going out. But of course, if you've got a big hole with the guide going through it, then you have a problem of an awful lot of helium going. These are practical details that we're working with now, and I don't know the answer.
Hi, Ed. If you could go back to the star CCM simulations, please.
Yes. Yes, this one?
Yeah, so you said that most of your YBF density was in these vortices to the left and right of the higher velocity flow. The shape of this higher velocity flow looks kind of like a classic Laval nozzle. If your cell was followed that contour, if the internal shape of it followed that contour, would you see a big boost in the number of molecules coming out?
Well, we haven't specifically set out to design something based on a Laval nozzle, but what we have done is fool around with the shape of the interior walls using this program to try to maximize the yield of YBF coming out. And certainly the first thing is to get rid of the vortices, but then in addition you can improve the yield by just changing the shape. So we have a shape which we've built and we're about to test. And yeah, it doesn't look unlike it's probably, if we'd said let's build a Laval nozzle, we wouldn't have been so very far different from what we've ended up with.
Thank you.
I'm wondering about your cooling scheme.
Yeah.
So you have two additional transitions which you have to repump.
Yeah.
Usually when you have this, so you should have some heating as well, right?
Some heating?
Right.
Well, it's molasses. So, I mean, yes, there is, of course, a minimum temperature, which is due to the competition between the heating and the cooling. And that's why, in our simulation, the temperature comes down like this and then equilibrates at about just below 200 microkelvin. That is because, at that point, the heating is equal to the cooling. So, I think we may be able to get lower if we have the benefit of polarization gradient cooling, but we didn't put that into our simulation. But so the heating is coming from the randomness of the photon kicks, but that's included in the simulation.
Thank you.
I was just wondering about the duty cycle of your cryosource experiment. I mean, without the cryo buffer gas cell, I would expect you just can run the experiment at a higher duty cycle, possibly. I mean, you had 600 hours, which is obviously quite, 10% of a year or so. So I was just wondering if you could comment on this.
You mean when we go to the cryosource, how many times a day or a week are we going to have to stop and regenerate? Well, we don't get a day. With the present source, we get I've forgotten how many, and we get a number of hours, 6 hours or something. So yeah, there'll be a trade-off, but it doesn't take very long to recycle it. So and maybe we can even automate it. I don't know.
Okay, you said part of your problem is also that the theory changes a bit or gives slightly different predictions from time to time. Is there other ways? Could you just measure some things to eliminate part of this? I mean, some other quantities. I mean, you probably have thought about this.
So, first of all, I don't do the theory. The theory is done by very specialized experts, one of whom is here, on this relativistic many-body quantum theory. There are, of course, tests. One of the fundamental things is to make sure that your theory can produce correctly the hyperfine structure and other known constants for the molecule. I think the present disagreement, there was a kind of consensus prior to this Indian result. I think the present disagreement comes about partly because they're trying a different method, which is still under development. There's an art in picking adequate basis set and so on. And you know, I think in the end it will be resolved. It's already at the kind of 10-15% level. We're talking about an essentially irrelevantly small discrepancy, right? It doesn't matter. Because the uncertainty in our measurement is much, the fractional uncertainty in our measurement is a whole lot bigger than the fractional uncertainty in the theory. But of course, when we measure if we measure non-zero, this would be a very important question. And I think it's a question that can be sorted out. It's a technical question about different ways of calculating this quantum chemistry, and they should give the same answer.
Okay, it's a very last question. Then we go together. Just a moment. I just wanted to ask the following question. So how many grams or kilograms of ytterbium fluoride do you use in your experiments, and how does it compare with LHC?
Actually, we use very little. You know, we have a little target. It's about less than a centimeter in diameter. Every time the laser hits it, we dig a little hole. So after a while, we can't use it, and we have to move it to another place. So how many grams? I don't know. Ytterbium is heavy stuff. Tens of grams for this experiment, probably. Most of which we didn't use. We still have the material, but it's full of holes and doesn't work very well.
Yeah. Right. You just have to compare with how many protons LHC you use, right? So.
I see. Yeah. I know how many molecules we use. We use 10 to the 12 molecules. The rest we wasted.
Okay, so let's sing again.